From NPR News, you're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered, a podcast that gathers the weekend's very best stories and features them on All Things Considered. I'm Laura Sullivan, in for Guy Raz. This episode, we ask a few questions. Can the country create jobs without spending money?
Government can't continue to spend and the economy grow and do well.
Then, what do Adolf Hitler, Martin Luther King, and John F. Kennedy all have in common?
Those who are more sane seem to do worse in crisis. Those who are less sane seem to do better in crisis.
Next, we find out why a local reporter took a licking on national television.
I started screaming and just like pacing the kitchen floor. Like, that did not just happen. No, that was my face. Oh my gosh.
We traveled to San Francisco's Mission District to find out the power of blues dancing.
Every dance is like a love affair.
Then back 30 years to a little-known caper called Operation Farewell.
It happened that an individual saw this, and it happened to be a policeman. And the policeman attempted to intervene, and Jetroff killed him.
Finally, guitarist L.D. Brown, who records under the name Gray Reverend. Just when his career was starting, he lost the use of two fingers. Now his first solo record is out, and it's called Of the Days.
I lost basically the ability to use my ring finger and my little finger on my left hand.
That's on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. If you start driving in Knoxville, Tennessee, and take I-75 about 20 miles west, eventually you hit a little town called Oak Ridge. And out there, on the Oak Ridge Turnpike, you can stop in for a salad or a sandwich at a roadside shop called Nature's Marketplace.
Oh, really? Well, we're kind of a word-of-mouth business, and then we do a lot of catering and business lunches.
Terry Frank runs the place. Starting at 4 a.m. every morning, you can find her in her kitchen here making the day's salads, sandwiches.
Well, I've already made the icing and then...
And a few desserts, too.
After it cools, you mix in the coconut and pecans.
Terry's got three boys, two in college.
I know my customers, when they come in, they say it makes them feel happy, so... But if you don't care to just hold on one second.
Sure.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
She and her husband are working 13-hour days just to keep the shop running.
And that sounds like a lot of work. Do you wish you could hire some more people to come help you?
Well, I have in the past. I guess in 2008, when things started kind of slowing down, you know, one of the full-time employees I had to cut back her hours. And no employer ever wants to cut somebody back or let them go, but then when it's also your livelihood and I've got to take care of, you know, my husband and I have to take care of our family and our mortgage payment.
What do you think government can do to help you?
Well, I think that government is the source of all of these problems. I honestly do. I'm not an economist, but I know that a lot of the people I have conversations with know that government can't continue to spend and the economy grow and do well. It just doesn't work.
Terry Frank is exactly the kind of person President Obama was trying to reach during his bus tour across the Midwest this week. People who are nervous about government growth and spending. People who could even create jobs, but aren't. That's our cover story today. When spending is a toxic word in Washington, what will it take to get businesses hiring? So I asked Terry Frank, what would it take?
I mean, to see, I guess, some positive numbers in the economy. I mean, this is my life. People like me and my husband, we're going to be smart and we're not going to try to expand or do anything like that if we don't know what tomorrow holds, if we think maybe the other shoe's going to drop and it's all going to implode.
In a moment, we'll speak with NPR's Scott Horsley. He traveled with the president all week while he made this pitch.
We should not have to choose between getting our fiscal house in order and jobs and growth. We can't afford to do just one or the other. We got to do both.
Now, we took this idea, jobs versus spending, to a couple of economists who you probably aren't surprised to hear don't always agree about this kind of thing. And we asked the question, is it possible to create jobs without the government spending more money?
Absolutely.
Economist Douglas Holtz-Aiken worked for Senator John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign.
it really depends on how much the government spends, how it finances it, and what it spends it on. And so I think the big concern that you hear businesses talking about is the fact that not this year's spending or next year's spending, but the spending for the next 10 years on things that are not productive infrastructure or basic research or education, but are on big transfer programs, big entitlements. Imagine, for example, Social Security reform. If we did Social Security reform, nothing would happen today. No current retiree would be affected a bit. Future retirees would know what they're going to get, so they'd be more confident about what they have to do. The world would see the United States fixing a major entitlement program, have greater confidence in our ability to manage our finances, no more Standard & Poor's downgrades. And businesses would say, yeah, Washington's not broken. They fixed something that needed fixed. Great. I feel better about the future. Let's go.
So every Republican who took part in this month's presidential debate in Iowa said that they would walk away from a deal that was 10 parts spending cuts and one part tax increases. Walk away. Why won't the Republicans budge on something like this?
So really three explanations. One is pure politics. The political heat of the moment surrounding it, they just can't afford to talk about raising taxes. The second is the history on the conservative side of budget deals, where it is their reading of the 96 budget deal and the 92 budget deal and then in the 80s that every time there was a compromise of spending cuts and tax increases, they did the tax increases and the spending cuts never materialized. So they're not going to do a dime of tax increases until they actually see the spending cut. And then the third is just the notion that the economy is very, very weak right now, and there's nothing about raising taxes that's good for economic growth.
But wouldn't you bring in more money, and then you can spend more money, which puts more money in the marketplace and creates jobs, and then
by taking money out of the marketplace with taxes, you then put the money back in the marketplace. At best, it's a wash. If you go again to a Social Security example where you fix Social Security and you solve a lot of our future debt problems, same would be true of fixing Medicare and Medicaid. You're not cutting the highway programs. You want to preserve the infrastructure programs, preserve the ones that actually provide a productive service to the economy.
That's Douglas Holtz Aiken, chief economic advisor to Senator John McCain in 2008. Okay, we had to do it. Same question, different economist. Is there any way to create more jobs out there without spending money, government money?
We want to spend money. We want to create demand for businesses so that they want to add to their payroll.
Gary Burtless has served as an economist with the Labor Department. Today, he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
That's the problem that we're in now. The world does not want to spend much. It doesn't want to spend much on investment. It doesn't want to spend a lot on consumer goods. There is, however, one actor that has the ability to speed up spending in this economy, and that's the government. The world is eager to lend money to the United States government at a 2% interest rate for 10 years. And the government, if it's willing to spend this money, can create additional demand to put people to work.
You're saying that the money isn't going to come from Terry Frank's sandwich shop. It's going to come from foreign governments. We're going to borrow the money from foreign governments. We're going to spread it around the United States. And that's going to create more people who want to buy Terry Frank's sandwiches.
I'm not saying that it's going to come from abroad. There are many Americans who are so frightened of stocks and private companies' bonds right now that they're eager to buy United States government debt. In spite of the downgrade, it is still regarded as the world's safest security, especially to people here in the United States. Well, if the government can borrow at these record low interest rates and put people usefully to work doing things that all of us agree would be real improvements in our communities.
So is there any way without government spending to create jobs?
Oh, eventually, I believe, even with somewhat foolish economic policy over the next 10 years. The problem is the terrible human waste that is going to occur over those 10 years. Unemployed college graduates, unemployed high school graduates, unemployed 45-year-olds who are trying to support families, and no one wants to put them to work because there is not enough aggregate demand to keep all of these willing workers employed. And that, I think, is a terrible waste.
economist Gary Burtless. NPR's Scott Horsley was with the president all week. He said that after Labor Day, he'd unveil a new jobs plan, and it's expected to include short-term spending. Scott's here now. And Scott, the store owner we heard from earlier, Terry Frank, voters like her have created this focus on spending cuts and deficits in Washington. Can the president change the conversation?
Well, Laura, you're right. Washington has been preoccupied with the deficit, almost to the exclusion of everything else, for months now. Mr. Obama himself has been going around saying the government needs to live within its means. But just in the last week or so, while he was on his Midwestern bus tour, he has begun to articulate more forcefully the idea that cutting government spending in the short run is not necessarily the path to prosperity. It could actually make a sputtering economy even worse. So what Mr. Obama is arguing instead is that the government should spend more money now to try to rev up the economy and then recoup that cost later with bigger savings and maybe additional tax revenues down the road.
The best thing we can do for our deficit and debt is grow the economy. Because when the economy is growing, more money in people's pockets, they pay more in taxes, and there's more revenue and fewer people on unemployment, and that helps to reduce the strains on our budget.
Well, if that's the case, why hasn't the president been pushing for more spending all along?
Well, if you think back, the first thing this president did when he got into office was to pass that giant stimulus bill. And if you imagine the economy as a stalled car, the stimulus was supposed to be like a push start to try to get it running again. Well, now it's 2.5 years later. Unemployment is still above 9%. A lot of voters think the stimulus was a big flop. And the White House knows this, and so the administration's been reluctant to give the car another push. Instead, they've been sort of watching it roll along, hoping the engine's going to kick in one of these days. And for a while, earlier this year, it looked like that might be starting to happen. But this summer, we have seen mounting evidence that the car, the economy, it's not picking up speed. In fact, it's slowing down, and there's a fear it might start rolling backwards. So the president is now in the position of saying, okay, everybody, gather around. We got to give this car another push. And that's not going to be easy.
So is the president going to call for a second round of economic stimulus?
I don't think you're going to hear the word stimulus from this president. rightly or wrongly, that has become a politically poisonous term. What's more, I don't think you're going to see anything on the scale of the original stimulus, which was $787 billion at the get-go. But Mr. Obama has been calling for some more modest measures. He's talked about extending the payroll tax cut. That would cost about $100 billion. He's talked about government help for public works projects. The White House strategy is basically, let's put something on the table that shows the president is thinking about jobs. If it works, great. And if Republicans keep it bottled up, well, that'll be fodder for next year's reelection campaign.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley from the White House. Thanks, Scott.
My pleasure, Laura.
Ready for a pop quiz? Which of these influential leaders was mentally ill?
We shall fight on the seas and oceans.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
The answer? All of them. Now, which of these leaders are mentally healthy?
So today I'm announcing that we're ramping up our efforts to get capital to small businesses in rural areas.
I have never been a quitter.
Let us increase the use of renewable power and emissions-free nuclear power.
The answer again, all of them. That's according to the new book by psychiatrist Nasir Ghami. It's called A First-Rate Madness, Confronting the Links Between Leadership and Mental Health. He says some of the world's greatest leaders have also suffered from mental illness, specifically depression and certain types of mania. And he says that's no coincidence.
And there's a good deal of research that shows that there are some benefits to mania and depression, such as creativity and resilience is higher in people with mania, and realism and empathy is higher in people with depression compared to normal subjects. The problem often with mentally healthy average leaders is research shows that the normal population has a mild positive illusion, the psychologists call it. We think that we're slightly more intelligent, slightly better looking than we really are. We tend to overestimate our control over our environment. And that can be quite fine under normal circumstances. That may actually help us to get more done because of that confidence. But a political leader needs to be able to be realistic rather than just optimistic for the sake of optimism.
You name a number of famous leaders in your book that
people have some knowledge of as being depressed or mentally ill. Lincoln, some people may be aware of Gandhi, but also Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy. Why did he get placed as mentally ill?
Well, some of the leaders that I describe have been understood to have had severe depression, at least, or even mania, like Lincoln, like Churchill. But historians have often not paid much attention to these features of their lives. They've just written them off as irrelevant to their leadership. So one thing I wanted to do was just to show that these symptoms not only were present in their lives, but were relevant to their leadership. And I tried to look back into their biographies and see what other historians may not have described as being related to depression or mania. In the case of King and Gandhi, for instance, they both made suicide attempts in adolescence, and both King and Gandhi had severe depressions before they were killed. And in the case of John Kennedy, his behaviors have been well known, his hypersexuality, his high energy, and so on. What I do is to go into the medical records and show how those symptoms really are consistent with this temperament called hyperthymic temperament in psychiatry, which means mild manic symptoms all the time. And then I base these diagnoses not just on these symptoms, but family history, because these illnesses are genetic. Mm-hmm. The course of an illness, it starts in young adulthood. It has repeated episodes throughout life in the case of bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And treatment, and I go over their treatment histories. In the case of Kennedy, I extensively describe his treatment with steroids, which worsened his manic symptoms. He was even treated with a neuroleptic, an antipsychotic, when he was in the White House for a period of depression.
Did that help him or hurt him?
In that case, it helped him. But he also abused anabolic steroids through most of the 1950s. So when those drugs made his symptoms much more severe and worse, he was a much less successful leader. I think that was the case in the first year or two of his administration. Then his doctors got it under control. They basically forced him to stop using so many of those drugs. And again, I document that. And this correlates with the last year of his administration, when a lot of his policies changed remarkably, and he became that major civil rights advocate, that very resilient Cold War leader who we now look back on and value so much.
So it was his ability to overcome all of those years of illness that led to that resilience? Is that what did it for him?
Yes. The hyperthymic temperament has been shown in studies to be the kind of personality that is most helpful in being able to withstand traumatic experiences like sexual abuse, war, and not develop post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. And I think that's what kept him alive and kept him going through the 1940s and 50s, whereas I think most of us wouldn't have even thought about running for president. We would have just wanted to be alive when we faced all the severe illness that he had.
You talk about George W. Bush and Barack Obama as two presidents who were mentally healthy, and you even put Tony Blair in that category. But you say that that could actually be a bad thing.
Right. And I think that there's a pattern here that seems to be relatively consistent, that when there are major crises like the Civil War, World War II, and it seems recently with 9/11, the leaders who we have who are mentally healthy, who have been successful before that time, don't seem to do so well. In the case of George W. Bush and Tony Blair, they have backgrounds that do not show any evidence of severe depression, severe mania, or extreme personality traits. So there's no reason to claim that they have any mental illness. They're within the range of average mental health. And if we think about these traits of leadership, one might examine how they dealt with the 9/11 crisis, mm-hmm. and whether their inability to be realistic about some things, such as weapons of mass destruction and that rationale for invading Iraq, was perhaps due to their being average people. And I think this is a reflection of the mild positive illusion, the mild optimism of normal mental health, which gets expanded when one reaches a position of great power. Whereas if someone's a little depressed, that illusion isn't there to begin with. And then in a position of power, one might be able to be more realistic, like Lincoln was, like Churchill was.
How does Barack Obama figure into all this?
Well, I think that Barack Obama has been presented to the public as being very mentally healthy and normal. He himself has used the phrase well-adjusted to describe himself. And this may be the case, and if so, I think it will be a limitation to him, perhaps, in his leadership in these times of great crisis. It's possible that he's a little less normal than we've been led to believe if we understand from his memoirs that he dealt with a lot of identity crisis personally and racially, which may have influenced his mood, his anxiety, his personality, and made him much more nuanced than the average person might be. But I think that many of us just believe that mental illness is inherently bad and mental health is inherently good. And the message from both the science and the history that I'm discussing here is that there's some good and some bad to both mental illness and mental health. You know, I think the idea of a no-drama Obama, of this very average, stable, healthy person, is a reflection, again, of that stigma, of the idea that if there's any mental abnormality, it must be harmful. And in fact, if he has a little bit of drama to him, it might be quite helpful.
Nasir Ghami is head of the Mood Disorders Program at Tufts University. His new book is A First-Rate Madness, Uncovering the Link Between Leadership and Mental Illness. He spoke to me from member station WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Nasir Ghami, thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Nice to be with you.
Things have been pretty busy for the staff of WOI News, the local ABC affiliate in Des Moines, Iowa, and not just because of last weekend's Republican straw poll. In fact, for one of the station's newest reporters, it's been positively surreal. Producer Brent Bachman has her story.
Okay, bear with me for a little exposition. For a few weeks now, comedian Stephen Colbert has been railing against this TV news station.
But WOI, ABC 5, you have f***ed with the wrong people.
And the long and short of it is, Colbert's beefing with this station in Iowa because this month, he wanted to air some political ads of his own. But the station, WOI, said no. That was a little more than a week ago.
It might just be the craziest week of my life.
This is 22-year-old Katie Eastman. She and I went to college together, which wasn't that long ago. She graduated this year and has been working as a reporter for just about 2 months in Des Moines for the station that's upset Stephen Colbert.
And
so let's pick it up last week, 2 days before the straw poll.
And I woke up to a barrage of voicemails, text messages, tweets.
All saying she was on the Colbert Report. So she and her boyfriend find the video online.
And we started watching, and I was like, oh, it's our station. I get it. The station that I work for. And then...
Now, clearly, someone needs to get to the bottom of this corruption. Someone on the inside. Like intrepid WOI reporter Katie Eastman.
And I just died.
Who has the courage to tackle the tough issues?
Jessica, it is the longest annual garage sale in Iowa.
Katie blew the lid off of garage sale gates.
I started screaming and just like pacing the kitchen floor. Like, that did not just happen. No, that was my face. Oh my gosh. It was really weird.
Now, for any number of local TV news reporters who've been mocked on late night television, that would have been it.
Little did I know.
On Monday night.
And you know who I think could really get to the bottom of this? Intrepid Cub reporter Katie Eastman. She has proven that she is a journalistic bloodhound.
The city of Des Moines has been talking about this park for a long time now, and dog owners of Des Moines couldn't be happier that the park is finally here.
So at this point, Katie and everyone else at her station are going through this whole complicated, I'm being mocked on national television by someone I really enjoy kind of thing.
I smell a Pulitzer.
Yeah, it's national television.
But meanwhile, she has to wonder.
Oh no, is this terrible for my career?
And not to mention...
Someone tweeted at me this morning that they had a dream about me last night.
Ooh.
Isn't that weird?
And yes, Katie's story raises some really serious questions about American celebrity culture. I mean, some stranger set up a Facebook fan page for her. The local Fuddruckers named a burger after her. But who are we really laughing at here? Katie? Ourselves? But instead of getting into all that...
Anything else?
2 days ago, Colbert invites the anchors at Katie's station on his show, who, of course, failed to deliver the crack reporting he wants.
Anybody got anything?
Well, the Barnstormers season opener is scheduled
Enough
for...
Enough with the Barnstormers! What about Perry? Where's intrepid Cub reporter Katie Eastman?
She's off today.
She's
what?
Off today. And I was.
Rachel,
I was
Amanda
off.
Fred,
so, I know,
me.
I know.
Remember, the whole world is watching.
You can laugh at yourself, and so that's what I've been doing. I'm just laughing at myself and laughing at everything.
We'll be right back.
That's intrepid Cub reporter Katie Eastman, and I'm Brent Bachman, NPR News.
We're going to take a turn now on the dance floor. There's a style called blues dancing. It's a kind of marriage between European and African-American styles, born in the Jim Crow South. They say that dancing to the blues is like falling in love. That's what attracted reporter Lindsay Lee Keel. Here's what she found.
I put a spell on you.
You hear that? It's Nina Simone, and this is the blues.
Cause you're mine.
It's Monday night in San Francisco's Mission District, and I've just arrived at the Polish Club. It's not a bar, it's a community center that tonight and every Monday night attracts a crowd of devout blues dancers. The room is warm, the windows have begun to fog, the lighting is dim, couples are close, dancing slowly, arms around necks, heads on shoulders, foreheads pressed together. Hips pulsate with the beat. Partners spin out for a moment of space between them, and then they move together again like molecules that can't resist each other. Though it might look like it, these dancers are not in love with each other. Some may not even know the name of the person they're dancing with, but everyone is here for that connection, for that feeling.
It's falling in love. That's what it is. It's crazy.
This is Kat Hughes. She's been a blues dancer for 3 years.
Every dance is like a love affair. You're falling in love for 3 minutes with the music, with your partner, with your connection. And it can be dangerous because you're falling in love like a million times a night, and it can really screw with your emotions, but it can also be amazing.
Dancing this way takes some getting used to. Back when she was first starting, blues dancer Crystal Wanberg remembers telling a prominent dancer in the scene how nervous she was.
And he was like, okay, just play along with me. Pretend that I am your one true love. And I kind of gave him this weird look. He's like, wait. I am your one true love, and I've been called off to war, and I'm leaving tomorrow. You may never see me again. He's like, dance with me like that. And I was just like, ah.
Wanberg was hesitant, but then she gave in.
And then we danced, and it was just the most incredibly connected dance. I was completely, completely done. Like, I was a blues dancer after that. It was done.
Many dancers talk about before blues and after blues. Vari Leggett started dancing almost 2 years ago. She says before blues, she had a drinking problem. She struggled with a negative body image. She sometimes felt suicidal. But after blues,
I have become more connected to my body. You can't go to a dance and say, I don't want to be reminded that my body exists, because that's what dancing is. And so that's extremely important for me, because I had never before found a situation where I wanted that to be true.
For Leggett, blues dancing is about transformation.
My release from fear and sadness started with getting sober and ended with learning to dance. Because of those two things, I am awake and I am healing.
Blues music was once called the devil's music. But for so many, blues has saved them. Though the Polish Club may not have a neon sign that says, "Blues saves," shining like a guiding light for the wayward, and you won't see dancers at your door holding pamphlets, for Hughes, Wanberg, and Leggett, the road to a better life began at the Church of Blues. For NPR News, I'm Lindsay Lee Keel.
We turn now from domestic intrigue to international with the little-known story of Operation Farewell. Years ago this summer, President Ronald Reagan was at an economic summit meeting foreign leaders in Canada, and French President Francois Mitterrand pulled him aside. What came next was startling. The French had a mole, a high-level KGB colonel, and Mitterrand wanted to know if Reagan wanted a piece of the action.
Well, his name is Vladimir Petrov.
That's Richard Allen. He was National Security Advisor at the time, and he was with Reagan in Ottawa.
Petrov was the incoming recipient of all of the stolen technology, and it was copious.
The KGB had a vast network of spies called Line X all over the world, stealing whatever technological advances they could get their hands on and funneling it all back to Petrov in Moscow.
And he was also the distributor to various users in, well, of course, in the military, in the government, and in whatever passed for industry in the Soviet Union. Petrov then decided to defect while remaining in place and declined all other offers of safe harbor, so to speak, in another country.
So he said, I'm going to become a double agent.
Well, I don't know if he said that, but he certainly became one.
So once you got this mole, Colonel Petrov, in sort of U.S. possession, what did you guys do with him?
Well, I had left by 1982, but Dr. Gus Weiss on my staff, who had previously been a staff member in the 1970s, developed along with the CIA a brilliant idea of providing the Soviets, who had come to rely on the technology that they stole and otherwise acquired, rotten technology that would test successfully for half a dozen or 10 or a dozen times, whatever it may be, and then would be deployed and be put into equipment and systems and things of that nature and be scheduled to implode at a given time.
Some of the rotten technology the U.S. fed to Petrov ended up in the control systems of a giant natural gas pipeline the Soviets were building. And that pipeline really did implode in June of 1982.
It not only imploded, but it exploded with a force of some 5 kilotons.
Why was the Siberian pipeline so important?
Well, it was about to feed natural gas to Western Europe, which could then become totally dependent on the Soviet Union, and that could bring about some unpleasant consequences for NATO members particularly.
Petrov also turned over the names of some 400 of the technology thieves he once oversaw, allowing the U.S. authorities to round them up and kick them out.
I think it was extraordinarily important because it was a major contributor to, if you will, breaking the will of the Soviet Union to go on.
So whatever happened to Colonel Petrov?
Petrov was on a tryst, if you will, with his girlfriend, his lover, and attacked her. And it happened that an individual saw this, and it happened to be a policeman. And the policeman attempted to intervene, and Petrov killed him. Petrov was sent to Siberia for that crime, and then his scheme was unraveled. He was brought to Moscow, interrogated brutally for a long time and tortured, and eventually executed.
That's former National Security Advisor Richard Allen speaking out after 30 years about the wild and ultimately tragic story of Vladimir Petrov and Operation Farewell. Now, time for music. This is finger-style guitar playing, one hand forming the chords, the other plucking out notes. It takes a certain dexterity and a whole lot of practice to get this good. So when aspiring guitarist Larry Brown started having trouble controlling two of his fingers, he thought his career might end almost as soon as it began. But here he is, playing the song you're listening to right now, without the use of those two fingers. He performs under the name Gray Reverend, and his debut solo album is called Of the Days. And the diagnosis for his fingers? Vocal dystonia.
It's a neurological misfiring to your digits. And it's something that happens to pianists, surgeons, typists, and guitar players. A particular person who is kind of famous for working through this is Leon Fischer, the classical pianist. I started dealing with problems with my hands within 2 or 3 years of playing the instrument.
When did you start playing the guitar?
15 years ago. So yeah, that would be 1996.
If you don't mind my asking, were you young? Were you a teenager?
No, I was 22 years old.
You started playing the guitar when you were 22 years old?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I started off kind of, I wanted to be Wes Montgomery.
The jazz guitarist.
Yes, I really wanted to just be this like ripping jazz guitar person. And then because of that, I practiced constantly. I probably played about 12 or 13 hours a day.
Wow.
And not to say that exactly leads to it. It's a very random disease that can affect anyone.
So the guitar playing, it sounds like exacerbated, sort of an underlying condition you didn't even know you had.
Yeah, I guess it was dormant to a degree, and it came out. And I lost basically the ability to use my ring finger and my little finger on my left hand.
What went through your head when that happened?
It was horrible. I didn't know what it was. For so long, I was seeing chiropractors and, everyone under the sun to try to figure out what was wrong with me. I thought I had arthritis, tendonitis, every other type of itis. And I finally went to see a piano player who was the first person to mention focal dystonia. And at first I thought like, oh, great, I'm brain damaged and, it's the end. But, I kind of looked it up, obviously, started reading more about it, and I realized that it was something I just kind of had to deal with, and I had to make a decision as to whether I would continue to play the instrument or not. And in making that decision, I became very immersed in different styles of guitar playing, kind of getting into folk singers such as Joni Mitchell and blues players like Mississippi John Hurt, and particularly John Fahey. I heard his music and his sound and what he was doing with the music seemed like something I could understand.
Did what happened to your fingers change the way you were playing the music, or did it, it sounds like you're saying it changed the music you were playing.
It did, to a very strong degree, in that I stopped using a guitar pick and I started learning how to play with my fingers on my right hand, more like a classical style or folk kind of finger picking style.
Far down the road, pioneer before an episode. You can't pull me through.
Basically, a lot of the syncopation and a lot of the movement that started to occur was happening more with my right hand than my left because I couldn't use the left as well. And I eventually developed a technique of using my thumb on my left hand to play very standard chords. And that helped me to be able to construct my own songs or write pieces of music that would have moving bass lines in them that you wouldn't hear very often.
Well, you brought your guitar with you.
I did.
Today. Would you mind playing a little bit from one of these new songs and tell me a little bit about it before you start?
Okay. I'll play a tune called Box. I was having a discussion with another musician. This is years ago in Philadelphia. He admired this guy he was working with who could write songs about anything. And he said he could write a song about a box. That's how that's how great this guy's writing is. I was challenged to write a song about a box. And to long story short, the approach to writing a song about a box was using the idea of something that, I feel like most people can identify with throughout growing up and having relationships is you always have this box of photos around that, have pictures of your ex lovers and friends. And sometimes you kind of, when you're cleaning or something, you'll find it and you just start kind of looking through it, and it can evoke such nostalgia. And that's kind of what this song is about.
Okay, so this is Gray Reverend with Box.
Some days seem to go so fast. getting lost in your photograph, taken just before sun goodbye. But I saved all that we could be in bonds made memories. Some say that it's not good for me. Doesn't matter where I go, up above or down below, no one knows the troubles I've seen. And I don't mind how you feel today, 'cause in time we all get thrown away. When it seems an expiration date is on our love. So don't ask me why it takes so long. Sometimes I see it when it's gone, and sometimes I'm made for holding on. It doesn't matter where I go, up above or down below, no one knows the troubles I've seen. You can say it's mystery, but everything's so clear to me when I look inside that box. It's to remind me
That is incredible. It's just lovely to listen to you to play the guitar like that.
Oh, thanks.
That's the music of Gray Reverend performing Box, a track off his new album Of the Days. He spoke to us from our New York bureau. Larry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Copper buttons, well, they're way too much. Silver laces again. Golden slippers that I paid you for, and still you walk the same. Sad and loving, well, it's tattered now. Seems the thick was just too thin. Free the dog from its collar now. And
thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program is directed by Petra Mayer. It's produced by Phil Harrell, with the assistance of Kenya Young, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Brent Bachman, and Megan Kane. Rick Holter is the senior editor. I'm Laura Sullivan. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays.
Friends you never have. Well, they're always far on this row of desolation. And on that trail I saw a diamond eye gazing softly on me. It was gyroscopic, so I dare not hide. Died without you next to me. stop the presses, cause we found our man in a suffocated shame. I saw you strutting the other day, still you walk the same.